is Susan V. Brock, Telluride Inside and Out, and I'm honored to be speaking with Kathleen Dean Moore. Kathleen Dean Moore is an environmental philosopher. She writes and speaks widely about the urgency of stopping climate change, which she regards as a moral obligation, and to that end has recently written another book, this one entitled Moral Ground, Ethical Action for a Planet in Peril. Kathleen Dean Moore is one of the distinguished speakers on the panel for the Moving Mountains Symposium coming up on Memorial Weekend, May 24th. It's all day Friday. Part of Mountain Film in Telluride. The subject of the symposium is climate solutions. Kathleen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome. So what is this exotic, esoteric thing called an environmental philosopher?
Oh, you know, it's not very fancy. Philosophy is the study of ideas. And environmental philosophy, then, is the study of the ideas that shape our relationship to the environment. So we environmental philosophers ask three questions. We ask, what is our best understanding about the world and the way the world works? And what is our place in that world, we humans? And then, given those answers, how shall we live? And boy, you better get those answers right, or you're going to make a real mess of things, and you're going to bring your world into a great kind of disruption. The problem is that for at least a couple hundred years, we've fooled ourselves into thinking that the world is just rocks and dumb brutes and ecosystem services, we say now, and that everything has been created especially for us, and it doesn't have any value apart from its value to our ends. And as far as our place in the world, we fooled ourselves into thinking that we're the masters of the universe, that we are the pinnacles of creation, that we are the reason for all of this, and that we're separate from the earth, fundamentally exempt from the rules that govern everything else, and that we're in control. And then how should we live? Well, given that, we can live any way we want, any kind of reckless or improvident or selfish or short-sighted darn way we want. We can mine out the earth, and we can hold this great going out of business sale without ever having to go out of business. We can do what Rachel Carson warned us against, which is imagine that we could destroy our habitats and not destroy ourselves. So my point is that we got it so wrong, and that experiment in that worldview is over, and the results are catastrophic. And so the question that environmental philosophers ask now is, what is a better set of answers to those three basic questions? I mean, how can we understand our relation to the earth in a way that invites us into the kind of life that is of the earth rather than in opposition to it? So that's basically the work of the environmental philosopher, as it's the work of everybody else on earth.
So my next question has to do what turned you towards your trade. Was it one event or a series of events that encouraged you to become a mother, teacher, writer, environmental philosopher?
No, you know, it's been a perfect storm. It's been a perfect combination of things. I am a mother, yes, I'm a mother and I'm a grandmother. And I love those little children, and they are utterly innocent. They didn't make this mess, but they're the ones who are going to bear the brunt of this freight train of consequences that's coming on them. And so as a mother and as a grandmother, I say, I'm not going to sacrifice their hopes and their futures for the sake of what? For the sake of increasing these already outrageous profits of the fossil fuel industry? Mm-hmm. I mean, what kind of a mother would make that trade? And so that's the way I think as a mother. And then at the same time, I'm a ethics professor, and I'll go into the classroom and I'll teach my students about distributive justice. And I'll teach them that when one group of people enjoys the advantages of this reckless consumption of fossil fuels and consumer goods, and then the burden of that privilege is placed on those people who are, or those beings who are powerless to resist and utterly blameless, that's distributive injustice by any name. That's a violation of every principle of justice. And then at the same time, I'm a writer. And worst of all, I'm a nature writer. And my job is to celebrate the world and to rejoice in birdsong and this the buzzing marsh and all these beautiful natural things. So what's a nature writer supposed to do when she's celebrating birdsong, for example, during the greatest mass extinction the world has seen since the asteroid hit the planet? And what's a nature writer to do when she's describing frog song as beautifully as she can and knowing that frogs are disappearing all around the world? And what can I write about a marsh when I come back a week later it's been destroyed by a bulldozer? So mother, philosopher, teacher, it all comes together. And they all came together through the one evening when I was sitting in the dark and my granddaughter was lying in bed kind of talking and singing herself to sleep. And she was hooting like an owl and she was giggling and she was singing, you know, like, laugh, kookaburra, hoot, hoot. And I was listening to this in the dark and I just said, you know, Kathy, it's over. That's it. It's over. You can't do anything but work to stop climate change. Who could make any other decision? You have to make the world safe for this child and for the laughter of other children and even for the laughter of the kookaburras. So I'm all in. I'm all in on climate change, and I don't see any choice.
And there really isn't, because there's not much good news these days about climate change. If anything, the changes are hitting faster and harder than the worst scientific projections could have ever imagined. How can you keep on working in a situation that may be hopeless?
Yeah, and I agree with you that we may be in a situation that's hopeless. Gus Speth, who's the former director of the Yale College of the Environment, he said, all we have to do to make sure that we leave a ruined world for our children is to do exactly what we're doing now. And then, of course, if you read the latest science, they're pointing out that the carbon dioxide load in the atmosphere now is 400 parts per million.
Yes.
It has not been that heavy since 3 million years ago in the Pliocene. And that was a time on Earth under those conditions when the Arctic temperatures were 12 degrees higher and the seas were 75 feet higher. So, hope, I don't know. But here's how I think about it. I think if we have a kind of blind hope that things will be all right, that somehow somebody's going to figure this out or the Earth will come to our rescue and it's going to be okay, that's a kind of moral abdication because it allows us to say, I don't need to do anything because everything's going to be fine. And then we have this idea that if we don't have that kind of hope, that our only option is to fall into a kind of despair. But despair is a kind of moral abdication, too. It's the abdication that says, you know, no matter what I do, it's not going to make any difference, so I might as well not change. So either way, you know, blind hope or blind desperation, we're not doing anything. And that is absolutely immobilizing, and I think that maybe accounts for so much of our inability to go forward. But the thing that strikes me is that that's a false dichotomy between hope and despair, and that really, between hope and despair, there's this very broad area that we could call moral integrity. And moral integrity is the notion that no matter what the outcome is, we need to find a way to match our actions to what we really believe. And we have to, for example, live gratefully because we believe that life on Earth is a gift. Or we will live simply because we don't believe in taking more than our fair share. And no matter whether the actions are going to save the world or not, and they may well not, I'm still going to do what I think is right. And the reason is that every decision I make about where I send my children to school, how I make a living, how I travel, where I travel, what I invest in, what I refuse to invest in, what I give up, all of these things are very loudly speaking either, yes, I believe in this, or no, I don't believe in it and I won't be any part of it. So honestly, I can live without hope. I'm quite content to give up on hope as a big motivator. The payoff doesn't matter so much as what matters is to do what you think is right. And I would point out that one of the things that amplifies this and that makes this so really important is that studies are showing that the one thing, overwhelmingly, that changes the behavior of a person is if that person can see another person doing something differently. So if I can find the courage to live with integrity, even in a time that I think might not come around, then at least I can be true to myself and at the same time an example to other people. Yeah, I understand the question. There is bad news. There is bad news out there, but we go on, don't we?
We go on. We don't despair. As you said, that's a sort of cop-out.
Yeah.
At Mountain Film, Kathleen, you will be preaching to the choir. What is the use of that?
I love preaching to the choir. You know, people say, oh, you should be talking with the climate deniers. You know, you should be convincing them that climate change is real and is dangerous and it's upon us. But I don't want to take my time to do that. You know, the statistics I see say that about 8 or 9% of the population in the United States are real diehard climate deniers. And I looked up to see, it turns out that that's almost exactly the same percentage of people who think that Elvis is still alive. So there are always going to be people. So there always are going to be people who aren't going to come around, and I don't think we need to spend any much more time worrying about that. And I don't think the politicians are going to help us. People say, "Oh, you should be out there talking to politicians and lobbying politicians," but honestly, they've been bought and sold like pork bellies. And the big question is, can they even follow our lead, let alone lead us? No, it's the choir. It's this community of caring that's going to get this done. I think about the civil rights movement, and I think about what turned the tide then, and it was people holding hands and walking out of the churches singing. So, you know, I don't want to be the one to preach to the choir. I don't want to preach to the choir. I don't want to be all solemn and wordy and self-satisfied and full of answers. But what I love to do is sing with the choir, and I want to be the lady. I don't want to be the preacher. I want to be the lady who rises up in the pew and she's weeping and she's shouting hallelujah and she doesn't have any answers, but she has the courage to ask really hard questions, and she doesn't have hope maybe, but she knows joy. Let's sing with the choir. Let's energize the choir. Let's empower them. Let's lift them up when they're weary. My friend Libby Roderick is a singer and a songwriter, and she's also a climate activist, and she's so tired. But she couldn't let herself go to sleep because she thought the work wasn't done, the job wasn't done. So she would lie awake all night and just tearing herself apart with this until she realized that, you know, when the sun is going down in my country, the sun is rising in someone else's. And that just as she's going to sleep, there's someone else who is getting up and getting back to work and taking up the cause. And she wrote this perfectly beautiful song. It says, "There are no promises that we'll see the day the dreams we live for will succeed. But I can promise you that halfway around the world, I'll hold the light up while you sleep." And this seems to me to be so important, that when we are singing with the choir, when we are part of this choir, we are part of a huge group, and it spans the globe. And we all have different parts to sing. And honestly, I believe that we're joined on the chorus by the earth and by the birds and the rain and the children. And that when we are tired or when we lose the way, somebody else is going to carry the tune. What could be more important than singing with the choir and raising the energy level of the choir? You know, Leonard Cohen, this is what I would tell the choir if I were ever asked to tell the choir anything. I would quote Leonard Cohen, who says, "Yes, we live with broken hearts in a broken world, but that's no excuse for anything. We have to sing the brokenhearted hallelujah."
This has been Susan Vibrock, Telluride Inside and Out, honored to be speaking with Professor of Environmental Philosophy, Kathleen Dean Moore. She will, at Mountain Film, be speaking about why it's important to understand climate action as a moral imperative, and what does moral integrity call us to do in the case of climate change? Those are among her topics at the Moving Mountains Symposium about climate solutions on Friday, March 24th. Kathleen, thank you so much for taking the time to join me.
Thank you, Susan.